Here's how President Trump described the killing of the leader of ISIS.
Absolutely perfect, as though you were watching a movie.
So how do other sources describe it? And what's the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi mean for a city he once ruled?
I'm Steve Inskeep with David Greene, and this is Up First from NPR News. The U.S. says it confirmed al-Baghdadi's death using DNA testing at the scene. What makes some in the region doubt that news?
And California firefighters are confronting wildfires and high winds as hundreds of thousands of people evacuate.
The combination of all of these factors make for a moment in our history that we hope we don't have to repeat.
Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a statewide emergency. How is the response to this round of fires affecting life here in the Golden State? Stay with us. We have the news you need to start your day.
Support for Up First and the following message come from Capital One, reimagining banking. They offer fee-free accounts that can be opened from anywhere in 5 minutes. That's less time than it takes to listen to Up First. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One N.A.
Support also comes from Vanguard. Vanguard was built around a radical idea that when you put people first, we all benefit. Together, Vanguard's 30 million investors are changing the way the world invests. Visit Vanguard.com or talk to your financial advisor.
One of the world's most wanted terrorists is dead. So what does this mean for the Islamic State?
President Trump announced the death of ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi yesterday.
When we landed with 8 helicopters, a large crew of brilliant fighters ran out of those helicopters and blew holes into the side of the building, not wanting to go through the main door because that was booby-trapped. And it was something really amazing to see.
According to the president, the man who once declared himself caliph soon died underground. How much of that story is verified? And what does it mean for the region where ISIS once ruled?
Well, let's bring in two of our correspondents. National security correspondent Greg Myrie is in our studio in Washington, D.C., and we're joined by NPR's Jane Araf, who's in Mosul, Iraq. Hello to you both.
Hi, David.
Hi, David.
Greg, I want to start with you. It's extraordinary that U.S. commandos pulled this off. We're told not experiencing any harm whatsoever. I mean, how did this go down?
Right. I mean, for starters, I have never heard such a vivid description of a top secret military operation by the president. He laid all this out. It was a late night raid on Saturday with these 8 helicopters we heard swooping in from a 70-minute flight. They had to go near areas where Russian and Syrian and Turkish troops were, real risk there. They blasted through a wall to get into this compound, and they took fire. They suppressed the fire, killing some of the people protecting al-Baghdadi. Tracked him into a tunnel in his compound. He took 3 kids with him, and according to the president, he detonated his suicide vest or belt, killing himself and 3 kids. And then the president added all this trash talk that saying that al-Baghdadi was whimpering and screaming and crying and that he died like a dog and died like a coward. So an incredible level of detail.
Any of all of that detail verified from other places or just some of it?
Well, some of it, sure. Some of this stuff there from inside the compound, we really have the president's word and nothing further.
I want to play a clip, Greg, from the defense secretary, Mark Esper. He was on CNN describing the impact of this death.
This is a devastating blow. This is not just their leader, it's their founder. He was an inspirational leader in many ways. He's the one that when he formed ISIS in 2014, he led to establishing the physical caliphate throughout the region. So this is a major blow to them.
Is this a major blow to ISIS, Greg?
Yes, I think if you look at it in this context, al-Baghdadi ran a terror group on an unprecedented scale. I mean, they controlled large parts of Iraq and Syria. They literally erased the border between these two countries. They administered big cities, gave services, collected taxes, recruited worldwide with this very sophisticated online operation. You need a leader and a structure and organization to do all that, and that is all gone. But I'll also add just a quick counterargument. There are still an estimated 15,000 ISIS fighters in Iraq and Syria, and they have affiliates from North Africa to Yemen to Afghanistan. They're still carrying out attacks. So it remains a threat, a disruptor, as sort of a traditional terrorist group.
Jane, I want to turn to you. So you're in Iraq, in the city of Mosul. We should remember that city was absolutely devastated by the Islamic State before it was liberated 2 years ago. So I wonder, how are people there, you know, people who have so much experience with ISIS, reacting to this?
Well, it's fascinating. We're actually just outside the very mosque where Baghdadi gave his speech declaring the caliphate, saying that he was the new leader. And we're on a street that has sprung up with little tea shops. Some of the businesses are coming back. These people who are in these shops were actually in the mosque on the day that Baghdadi gave that speech. And so we've been asking them about that, about what they thought. And they said basically they'd never heard of this guy before, and all of a sudden he appears. But here's the interesting thing. When we ask them what they think of the fact that he is now dead, they actually, a lot of them, don't believe he's dead. And even more than that, some of them don't believe he ever really existed as the man who the Americans say he was. They say he was an invention. It was all a big film.
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, I want to ask you, too. I mean, it sounds like the Americans, I mean, even though they had, you know, all of this intelligence that led them to Baghdadi, the fact that he was in northwestern Syria really surprised them. Why would that be?
Well, he was trying to escape. So this is a guy who had had a $25 million bounty on his head. And we have to remember, we're talking about huge territory in between the western desert and Iraq and Syria. So they'd been chasing him for a while. The idea is, the feeling is, that he was potentially trying to escape to Turkey with his family. According to the Iraqis, they say this had been going on for 4 months that they'd been tracking him, that they provided intelligence. But this was obviously teamwork on the part of a lot of countries. And here was a guy who had successfully hidden for most of the past 5 years, and that's where they found him.
Well, Greg, I mean, Jane mentions there was teamwork here, and President Trump thanked other countries. I mean, he gave Russia top billing, we should say, but he also thanked the Syrian Kurds. And this is at a moment, of course, where the United States, after the president ordered this withdrawal of troops from Syria, where the Syrian Kurds feel really betrayed. Did this mission prove that they're, you know, how vital they really have been in their allegiance with the United States?
Yeah, I think it was further proof, as if we needed it. I mean, it's been very clear that they've been a absolute key partner for the past several years, as the United States has defeated ISIS with a very small force, and it's been the Kurds who've been doing the fighting. And the president, even as he spoke yesterday, mentioned that a fresh sensitive material was found at al-Baghdadi's compound. Well, that's something you may want to act on very quickly, and you need partners. You need to work with your friends in the region. So even the president provided evidence for that.
International correspondent Jane Arraf in Mosul, and we had national security correspondent Greg Myrie with us in the studio in Washington, D.C. All right, so here in California, the governor, Gavin Newsom, has declared a statewide emergency as the state is yet again battling wildfires.
The largest is the Kincade Fire in Sonoma County's wine country north of San Francisco. Ferocious winds have fueled that fire. And this next statistic gives a sense of the vast scale of things in California, including disasters. At this point, almost 200,000 people have been ordered to evacuate.
NPR's Eric Westerveld is on the ground covering this in Sonoma County. And Eric, what do things look like there?
Yeah, good morning, David. I mean, with these really strong, at times hurricane-force winds Sunday, firefighters have actually lost ground on this blaze in the last day. I mean, containment of this fire is down from 10% to just 5%. It's burned nearly 55,000 acres, destroyed about 100 structures, no fatalities, but on Sunday, a firefighter was seriously burned and airlifted for immediate treatment. Mm. And David, all day, we watched these crews putting enormous resources into saving homes and trying to. I mean, we watched a ground crew and a helicopter dump, you know, basket after basket of water, working tirelessly to stop these flames from moving down just this one hillside in the fire towards a large estate and vineyard with many structures near a roadway. And, you know, finally, as the flames died down, I went up to the house and spoke with Eric Kamula and his crew with the Woodland Fire Department.
You guys kind of saved these homes right here.
Well, everybody saved the homes. I mean, the helicopter took a lot of the heat out of it, and our engines just came in behind it and just doing a little bit of mop-up. So just make sure everything's tight and everything's out, especially with the wind, we have to.
Yeah.
David, it's just one example of sort of all the effort it's taken to stop some of these wind-driven flare-ups all across this fire. And, you know, they didn't always succeed. We saw a business burn to the ground. Some of the Soda Rock Winery's buildings dated back to 1869.
Wow. It's always amazing to hear a firefighter just a little mop up. You know, the duty is much harder than they're ever going to really let on.
Absolutely.
So these evacuations, as Steve mentioned, their power outages to try and, you know, avoid causing fires, their road closures. How are people holding up in general?
People are pretty tired and anxious up here in the fire zone. I mean, we visited an evacuation shelter where people had to flee in the middle of the night. People were tired. Many residents, you know, simple things, trying to gas up. They can't because power's off. You know, the pumps weren't working. We met an elderly woman who was a bit panicked. She'd run out of gas at this checkpoint and didn't, you know what to do. We gave her some food and water, and a police officer was going to try to help her. But we saw those scenes playing out again and again. I mean, on Highway 101, this main north-south road in the region was closed in one part for really much of yesterday, making movement and refueling hard. We met Diane Ophel as she was stuck at an exit ramp on 101. She's lived in this area for more than 40 years and says this is really the first time she's had to flee a wildfire.
People are adapting and figuring out what to do. This is new for us to have to evacuate. I didn't think it would happen. I'm old. This is new. This is a firestorm. This isn't just a fire.
And David, that's a real fear here, you know, with these strong winds, which could pick up again tomorrow. They can take off so fast, you know, just like these deadly firestorms in the cities of Santa Rosa and Paradise that we've seen over the last 2 years here in California.
Yeah, that was definitely one of the lessons from last year. I mean, how quickly these fires can get out of control and even take out much of a community. NPR's Eric Westerveld reporting on the fires in Sonoma County, California. Thanks, Eric.
You're welcome.
All right, that's Up First for Monday, October 28th. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Up First returns tomorrow, but you can hear more from NPR right now. Check out our new daily science podcast, Shortwave. On this episode, one day your phone rings and somebody says, "Congratulations, you're a genius. Here are $625,000. That's how the MacArthur Fellowship works. Meet two of this year's winners, two climate scientists who study the oceans in surprising ways. That's today on Shortwave, NPR's new daily science podcast.
Kids sometimes say the craziest things, but what if those weird things aren't things they just picked up on the playground or on YouTube?
"Oh, my dad's dead." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, no, my other dad is dead.
What if they're part of a phenomenon we're calling memory catching? Young children remembering details of past lives. On the latest episode of Invisibilia from NPR.